Good morning, Oregon. I'm Finn J.D. John, FJ at OffbeatOregon.com, and this is the Daily Offbeat Oregon History Podcast. Thanks for downloading, and I hope you enjoy the show. This story was first published on February 9th of 2014 under the headline Legendary Hell-Raising Rustler Hank Vaughn, The Early Years. It's part one of a three-part series on Hank Vaughn. Here we go. Crime, they say, does not pay. Yet it's pretty easy to look back through history and find examples of a certain kind of criminal for whom it did pay, handsomely and for decades. With charisma, moxie, and a seemingly endless supply of good luck, these characters sometimes even manage to cheat karma and die a natural death. And somehow, after these criminals are gone, people remember them with a kind of fascinated fondness and say things like, well, we'll never see another one like that again. The second half of the 19th century saw such a man in a larger-than-life Wild West character named Hank Vaughn. Hank Vaughn is remembered by folks who met him sober as a slender, wiry fellow with a sober look, a full set of whiskers, and a Prince Albert-style coat. Very affable and charming, but with blue-gray eyes that seemed to hold you. Most people liked him, even if they were a little afraid of him. Others didn't like him much at all, especially the owners of the horses and cattle that would reliably vanish when he came around their herds. Hank was, for most of his life, a horse thief and a rustler. Possibly the most successful rustler in the history of the Old West. But then there were the folks who met Hank when he was drunk. Some of these didn't survive the experience. Hank Vaughn was in at least a dozen gunfights in his life. There are old saloon buildings in the Dalles and Pendleton and Athena that still have 45 caliber slugs embedded in their woodwork from his colts and gouges on their floors from his horse's hooves. Historian Noah Brown, a former employee at the Umpqua House Saloon in the Dalles, describes a typical scene from Vaughn's heyday, as quoted in John and Donna Scovlin's excellent biography of this hell-raising horse trader. Quote, "On Vaughn entering the saloon, drinks were ordered for the house," he writes. "Needless to say, a crowd ambled up to the mahogany and foot rail and the sampling of Old Crow until the room was full to overflowing. It was not a great while until nearly every individual was in the same fix. A shot fired from a six-shooter in a frolicsome way pierced a hole through a back bar mirror. Tabs were kept on all drinks, damage to furniture, incidental expenses added, and by the next evening, those typical early-day Western trailblazers and pioneer characters paid the full lucre for their gentlemanly tête-à-tête of their own liking in the year of 1881. In riotous barroom scenes like this, Vaughn was the first among equals. He was a fun if dangerous friend, happy-go-lucky and fearless in any kind of fight. His skills as a horseman were legendary, and he could drive nails with a pistol from 20 yards away. But if you were a horse rancher or a cattle drover, he was the last guy you wanted to see. Hank Vaughn was born in 1849, near Brownsville in the Willamette Valley. He was one of the very first babies born in the old Oregon Territory, although some historians would later try to claim that he was really from Missouri, motivated apparently by a desire to keep the Beaver State's reputation free of the stigma of having produced such a rascal. Hank's family moved to Canyon City when he was about 12 or 13. By age 15, he was an active horse trader with a chip on his shoulder and a pistol on his hip, with which that very year he made his very first attempt to kill somebody. A customer named William Headspot, to whom Hank had been foolish enough to sell a horse on credit, tried to buffalo the boy by jeering at him and claiming the horse he'd bought from him was stolen. It probably wasn't, but it might have been. In any case, Hank, incensed by this insult, pulled his colt and used it to carve a bullet-shaped furrow across Headspot's scalp. Half an inch lower and Hank would have been facing a murder rap. He was arrested and charged, but he didn't really face much risk of being convicted because of Headspot's behavior. However, a few months later, free on bond, Hank saw the man who'd signed the arrest complaint walking into a saloon in which he was drinking. Out came the six-shooter again. The wound Hank inflicted on his antagonist with his pistol doesn't seem to have been very serious. But now, Hank's situation was. It was one thing to reply to an insult with gunfire. The Canyon City miners and cowboys didn't approve of that, but they understood, and most of them figured Head Spotted had it coming. But to retaliate in semi-cold blood against a man for doing his duty as a citizen, that was entirely different. Had Hank's aim been better, he almost certainly would have been lynched that day. As it was, he spent 4 months in jail, at the end of which he copped a plea, a $1 fine, and an agreement to join the 1st Oregon Volunteer Infantry. Well, that lasted just a few months. 6 weeks after Hank mustered in, the Army spat him out. He left with a dishonorable discharge, but it did save him from the state pen and left him free to get back to the business that was already clearly his forte, horse theft. But he wouldn't do it for long, because it was just 3 months after Hank left the Army that he and a friend, Dick Bunton, traveled to the foothills of the Blue Mountains to steal a few good horses from a ranch there and head for the Idaho Territory with them. But Umatilla County Sheriff Frank Maddock and Deputy Jackson Hart were hot on their trail. The two men got the drop on the boys one night when they were camping by Swayze Creek near the Burnt River close by the Idaho border. And when the two lawmen slipped up to the sleeping boys and yelled for them to throw up their hands, they both woke up shooting. The ensuing gunfight was short, but very eventful. Deputy Hart was killed on the spot. So was Hank's companion, Dick Bunton. Sheriff Maddock was wounded badly, a bullet actually passing through his skull and breaking his jaw and wrecking his inner ear and knocked unconscious. And Hank was hit in the thigh and scalp. Well, it's hard to stay on the lam with a bullet in your leg. So Hank was soon captured. Dragged back to the notoriously rope-happy town of Auburn to stand trial, Hank was nearly lynched by an angry crowd, and if it had not been for the intervention of future U.S. Representative John Haley, who stood between the crowd and the jail with a cocked Colt in each fist until they gave up and dispersed, that would have been the end for Hank. The trial was fast and the outcome not much in doubt. The Dalles Weekly Mountaineer reported its outcome on June 16, 1865. Quote, Henry Vaughn, the boy thief and murderer, arrived at the Dalles yesterday in custody of an officer on his way to the penitentiary where he is to pass the remainder of his life. This fellow is a youth, yet he is steeped in crime and regarded as one of the worst villains that ever cursed the country. It is to be hoped that he will not be permitted to escape, as in the event of his return to this country, he is sure to be hung. And so to prison Hank went. He was under a life sentence, but he would only serve 5 years. Some historians have claimed that prison turned him from a wild but good-hearted boy into a hard-eyed monster, which is a fairly common pattern in such cases. However, the Hank Vaughn that emerged from prison seems to have been less dangerous rather than more. He definitely was more successful in his rustling endeavors after he got out. And while he certainly had his enemies and gotten his share of gunfights and scrapes with the law, the post-prison Hank Vaughn seems to have developed an ability to fit into and even dominate frontier social life. He'd never face a lynch mob again, because he'd learned how to get what he wanted from society without getting identified as a deadly threat. Prison seems to have given Hank the discipline and social skills he'd need to survive and thrive in the 1870s and 1880s on the Oregon frontier. And we'll talk about how that went next week. Key sources in this story have included works by John and Donna Scovlin and Bill Gulick. Well, that's our show for today. Thanks again for listening. This podcast is part of Offbeat Oregon History, a public history resource for the state we love. What you've been listening to is one of more than 700 stories originally created and published as newspaper columns in first-run syndication between 2008 and today. You can read them all at offbeatoregon.com. Other Offbeat Oregon goodies include an active Facebook page, a ton of historic photos, and a bunch more stuff, including visuals for today's show and full citations to sources, all accessible via our hub page at offbeatoregon.com. By the way, if you like this kind of stuff, you might be interested in my other podcast. It's called The Penny Dreadful Story Hour, and it's basically an early Victorian variety show. I read a chapter from each of six classic penny dreadful story papers published between 1840 and 1866 with historical and sociological commentary and definitions of the flash cant slang lingo used by Romany family coves and bold highway robbers and titled Regency roisterers and such. The dreadfuls we're working through right now are Sweeney Todd, Highwayman Dick Turpin, Varney the Vampire, an international espionage series called The Black Band, and a couple other whacking great stories. Check it out. You'll find it wherever you get your podcasts, or you can cut straight to it at pulp-lit.com/pennydread. Our theme music is by the Atlas String Band and was written by Carmen Ficarra. Listen and learn more at atlasstringband.com. Questions, critiques, ideas for a future episode? Email me at fj@offbeatorgan.com. Episodes of Offbeat Oregon History are uploaded around 6 a.m. every weekday, so the next one will be on your device and ready to go before you know it. Until then, go out and fill up the rest of the day with good stuff. Bye now.